subject back here.
The life of a tube is heavily dependent on what temperature you run the cathode at. In the case of the 4CX250B, you were supposed to run 6.0 volts on the filament until you started using it in high power Class C UHF service. In the case of 450 megacycle service, the highest frequency, or 500 megacycle service, the highest frequency the tube is rated for, and you're applying something like 10 watts of drive to the control grid, and because the tube has enough physical size to it, you're starting to get a phenomenon called transit time loading. That's a fancy way of saying that each electron leaving that cathode, going to that control grid, not all of them have enough time to get to the plate on that half cycle of the RF wave. Some of them at the tail end of that positive half cycle don't quite make it, and those electrons go flying back to the cathode and crash into the cathode. It's called the back bombardment phenomenon. Let me drop. Therefore, if you wanted maximum life out of the tube, when you were using it at maximum power output at the maximum frequency, 500 megacycles, where this back bombardment was taking place, you were being requested to lower the voltage on the filament from 6.0 down to 5.5 during the time that drive was applied so that you didn't overheat the cathode. The tube is not going to suddenly explode if you run it at 6.3 volts instead of 6.0. But the life of a filament of an incandescent bulb is a function of the voltage you apply raised to the 12th power. A very small increase in voltage, and you're going to think that's a very small increase in extra temperature, drastically cuts down the life. So that tube, if you treat it with tender loving care, I'll bet you can easily get 50,000 hours of life out of that particular tube, a very rugged tube. But during that lifetime, all these exotic chemicals that are built into that cathode assembly that's being indirectly heated with that filament, all of those exotic chemicals are boiling up to the surface at just the right rate to keep that cathode giving you the right amount of emission. So you obey that filament voltage if you want maximum life out of the tube. In my opinion, it seems like a small deal, but there are people who made a big deal out of this one. Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, okay, I was wondering why you said that, and I'm assuming now this applies to all tubes, to try to keep the correct voltage. So the idea is to extend the life, basically, of the tube. Understood. I was just wondering about that. So, or is it just, this, you know, was it critical with this particular tube? I don't have any tube equipment here, but, it made me think after you mentioned the 6.3 versus the 6, why that was so important. Is it specifically for, these types of tubes, or is that just a general practice for all tubes, try to keep the voltage right, but really make sure this one is right? Back to you, Dick.
I've got a gut feel that this particular tube is a little bit more persnickety on that. The cathode was carefully designed. The control grid and screen grid and suppressor grid were all very carefully aligned so that it was a beam grid tetrode tube. In other words, the signals coming off that control grid were carefully aligned into vertically polarized sheets of electrons that wiggled in between those wires of the control grid, screen grid, and suppressor grid so that there was very little grid interception and you got highest possible efficiency. It was a carefully designed tube. It is a carefully designed tube with a lot of capability. So all transmitting tubes, you should be a little bit careful on filament voltage, but this particular one, I think you got to be a little bit more careful because, as I said, it was kind of an exotic tube. I know that they did not want you turning on the B-plus before the filament had a chance to completely heat the cathode, and it was never quite clear to me as to why that was. I think it's because you would get hot spots of emission on the cathode if you didn't wait for the proper warm-up time. And maybe people were making jokes, but they said that if you asked for full power output from the tube before the filament had a chance to heat the cathode, you would be yanking chunks off of that cathode. I think they were exaggerating, but we heard people saying things like that. You could abuse that tube by not giving it the right warm-up time. I bet you heard similar things, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Somebody said something. Pick him up about Romania.
Yeah, who told us about Romania? And was that Svetlana? And are they still shipping tubes?
Yeah, that was Antonio. Antonio, good evening. Yeah, I think I've seen a bunch of them somewhere in Romania. So they are still alive and kicking, basically out of the military that threw them actually away the day that they have had to convert to NATO. And to Antonio, back to you, Dick.
Okay, thank you, Alex. So they still exist. I guess it's a matter of time before Svetlana starts getting some flack from their local community. Every company that builds tubes, vacuum tubes, has to use a whole lot of heavy metal chemistry, and disposing of those heavy metal waste products quite often involves contaminating the soil around the company. Lots and lots of companies have in the past run into that situation. The Amperec Tube Company on Long Island had a factory, I can't remember what town it's in, but that factory sits there as a fallow piece of land that's heavily contaminated, and here we are 30 some odd years downrange, and that's a unused piece of land because of the contamination of the process of producing those tubes. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Any of those places that process metals of any sort have that problem. Right here in New York, right up, not far up here, there was the Anaconda Cable Company. Big operation during World War II, supplied the Navy. Most all the Navy's copper wire was supplied by Anaconda. And the contamination around the plant right off the river, right off the East River, I believe it was off the East River somewhere. Yeah, the contamination around that plant, and this is a big plant, I mean, this one for a couple of blocks, is terrible what they said was in the soil around it. So I don't know. I haven't been there quite a while, but I remember the whole place was just gated off and left like that for so many years that no development in anywhere around there, Dick, over.
Yeah, there were stories of people living in private homes nearby who got sick, and eventually those homes had to be abandoned. So these heavy thoriated metals and whatever that are required for cathode production produce a whole lot of waste products, and in those days we were too foolish to know about how to dispose of those waste products. Some companies just dumped them into the soil nearby, some of them pumped them back into a well, contaminated the local water supply. All kinds of terrible things were happening. And that wasn't that many years ago that that kind of jazz was going on. I'll bet you quite a bit of it was happening into the 1970s. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, that's a whole story in itself. As far as the tube goes, 4CX250B, yeah, I used them in a mobile, and I destroyed them. I never could understand. I said, what was going on there? I thought it was the vibration of bouncing them around in the car because the unit was in the trunk. But it came down to, I was going to mention that, my problem was my filament pole, which was DC, and it went up quite high, you know, because, let's face it, I was running right across the DC. My filament was whatever was coming, you know, across my battery system. Because I never considered, that the filament couldn't be stretched like that, maybe to about 14 volts, you know, for a pair of them. And they were in series. So that's how I had wired it. I had used two in series, the filament. And the voltage, and of course, exceeded the 12 volts, which should have been, and by quite a bit. So I knocked off a number of them over a few years that I had the mobile rig. The kilowatt mobile rig, but like I said, it was so cheap and all, I didn't worry much about it. Let me think, anything else? Oh yes, on the Collins rig, Collins KWS-1, they have specifically monitoring the filament foliage of the final stick, over.
Yeah, that's just a meter on the front panel. giving you the 6.0 volt setting point with probably a potentiometer. In the case of your tube that you were running 14 volts of two tubes in series for the filaments, was it a slow failure or did the filaments just suddenly develop an open circuit mill? And one other thing to worry about with that tube is that if you ever apply screen grid voltage and drive to that tube without the plate voltage being present, then that beam of electrons that comes roaring off that cathode, when they go through that screen grid, if they're not looking at a more positive plate and they stick to the screen grid, the screen current will climb real high, real fast, and in about 5 seconds, you burn down that screen. So unless there's some kind of a screen current protection network, you can destroy those tubes in 5 seconds. Over to you, Mel. Don't worry about the beep. A carrier drop is all it requires. We're not resetting the internet. There isn't any.
Okay, yeah, one time it does it, one time it don't. Okay. Yeah, roger. in fact, the answer to that problem was that they told you to put a bunch of 2-watt resistors in parallel on the input that would basically, they took a whole bunch of 1,000-ohm resistors, I forgot, and you pile them together, so you come down to 50 ohms, I think like 22-watt resistors or something, and you put it across the input, and that was supposedly to protect it, Dick, over.
Well, what I used in my article that was in the April and May issue, 1972, of QST Magazine, I put a 2,000-ohm 12-watt resistor in series between the screen and the screen supply. That way, if anything went wrong and the screen grid started drawing high current, the screen voltage automatically would drop through that resistor, and it would keep the screen dissipation to a safe number. So that's one way of doing it. Other guys would put a current sensing circuit with a relay that would remove the voltage when the screen current got exceeded. You couldn't go more than 12 watts of dissipation, which I remember was something in the vicinity of 10 or 12 or 30 milliamps, something like 10 milliamps was the maximum screen current I think you could tolerate with 300 volts without exceeding the screen dissipation of 12 watts. I guess we could do that multiplication. I guess it's 30 milliamps. Can't exceed 30 milliamps with 300 volts on the screen. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, roger. Yeah, remember it quite well. I did all kinds of things to those tubes. I'm sure I destroyed it. Number of them in my fooling around with all kinds of ideas, but it was a great tube when it was especially available, very cheap because you could really had a lot of fun. You could build yourself an amplifier. You didn't worry about, you know, what it would cost to put together. It's a very cheap amplifier. You could homebrew and work quite well. Give you a nice power output that easily gave you a 10 dB gain in most cases from your exciters. So it was really well worth, you know, working with. All right, should we look for something else right now?
Yeah, I think it gave me a lot more than 10 dB of gain. On 2 meters, 5 watts of input gave me close to 500 watts of input power to the output stage, 300 watts out. I was getting more than 17 dB of gain out of that tube, Mel. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I would assume that you could do that. I'm talking about basically the HF amplifier that I ran. I think I, if I remember correctly, it was around 10 dB gain that I was getting from my small what the heck did I have in a mobile? I forgot already. I had transceiver, I don't remember the make of it. It was one of the early birds. I think it ran around 50 watts, I think, Dick. Okay, anyhow, should we look at something else?
Sure can. Go right ahead. And by the way, were you running it in grounded grid service, driven cathode?
Oh, no, the cathode was grounded. I was running it, if I remember, in its classic way of driving it, Dick. I don't remember running it. I remember grounding the cathode, over.
Okay. grounded grid service only needed a couple of watts for Class C. And if you were running Class A, I'll bet you one or two watts is all it needed for drive, as long as you were resonating that control grid. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I was running at AB1. Yep, AB1, Dick.
Okay, a couple of watts would drive it, and you could get 300 watts out of that if you had 2,000 on the plate. And maybe you were only running 1,000, because a 2,000 watt mobile supply, that's quite an enthusiastic endeavor. Go ahead to the next question.
Yeah, Roger, that power supply varied all over the place. Remember, I can only run the amplifier to get the plate voltage is when the alternator, when the leaf navel was turning. So without the leaf navel turning, and of course you're driving along, it went up and down and up and down the plate voltage. So I don't remember how I decided to do run it in grounded cathode. I don't remember what I did. It's a long time ago. All right, let's look at something else. Here. Okay, I bought at a Hamvention what is known as a directional coupler made by W1NTH. I never knew he was in the business of making them. I think I once heard of that guy. Oh, and the device was designed and manufactured by W1NTH and designed by Tom McMullen, W1SL. These are made of copper. Oh, I see. It was made of copper pipe. I think I remember seeing that with end connectors on the end. Now it stopped working. Can you tell me why it was all of a sudden stopped working? You know what I'm talking about, Dick. I remember seeing them on a market once. Over.
Yeah, Tom McMullen was one of the VHF mavens at ARRL headquarters. Had quite a series of articles in QST magazine. I visited Tom at his house in Connecticut way back in the 70s, and haven't heard very much from him lately. Had to look him up and see if Tom McMullen is still alive and kicking. But he had a series of articles of how to take a 3/4-inch water pipe and make them into directional couplers for coaxial power sampling for transmitters. He was building the poor man's equivalent of a bird wattmeter. So he's got a strip of copper at a T connector made out of copper water pipe that picks up the signal and goes into a diode rectifier. Now the diode rectifier was something like a 1N21 diode. And if you're not careful with ESD practices, electrostatic discharge practices, it's fairly easy to wipe out that diode. In other words, a person could pick up a piece of coaxial cable that's intended to go from the sampling port on his directional coupler into some kind of a meter circuit. And if there's a charged voltage on that coaxial cable at the input you connect it to that output connector, in theory you could damage that 1N21 diode. With a very careful operation with a ohmmeter, you can probably confirm whether or not the diode is good or actually replace it. But a directional coupler of that style is really built like something very rugged. There's nothing there that's delicate other than the rectifying diode itself, or some kind of a mechanical failure due to a complete open circuit, a solder joint that breaks. And in theory, that can be detected by a visual inspection. Because I do remember there was a telescoping piece of tubing on this thing where you could move it and then clamp it down with a hose clamp and adjust the coupling coefficient. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Now, Roger, this is K2KEY. I'm trying to picture it now. I think I remember it. It was a copper coupling, a T coupling, if I'm not mistaken, and you put on the ends, each end was an end connector, N-type connector, I think he had, and I could say he had like a little pickup loop, he had a copper pipe, I think like a 1/4-inch piece of copper pipe that went from the center of each end connector right through. And then they had a pickup. Yeah, I'm picturing it as a bird watt meter, you know, like you say, a cheapy poor bird watt meter. And I think he used a germanium diode in there. Yeah. I think, was it a 1N34, Dick, over?
Could very well have been. And the good news about a 1N34 is they're pretty rugged. But if he did use the more sensitive 1N21, they were not so rugged. You could wipe them out with electrostatic discharge. So, by way of a visual inspection, putting the right power through it, doing some ohmmeter tests. A directional coupler can be troubleshot. There isn't rocket science in there. The method of operation is somewhat simple, not too difficult to understand. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Yeah, I remember they was selling them. They right. They went into some guy. Yeah, I guess that was the one that went started making them. W1NTH started making them and selling them for. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, what they used to do is they put one way and one the other way, so that you could, I guess, look at forward and reflected power simultaneously. Am I correct? Over.
I'm pretty sure that Tom's original article in QST Magazine was a dual directional coupler. So it was a complete Vizsla bridge and power meter when properly calibrated. Go ahead.
But when he came up with it, let me remember, because I'm trying to focus in on it. You took one of them, and if you took it and you reversed it, one way you'd read FWR, the other way, if you turned it around, you'd read forward power. So what you could do is you took two of them, one way and one the other, and put them, like, in series, and you could simultaneously then sample both forward and reflected power. Am I correct? Over.
I think so. You could either use one meter with a switch that decided which way you connected the meter, or you could have two separate meters and read simultaneously forward and reverse power. And if you wanted to go to the next step, you would have a dual meter movement where the crisscrossing of the meter read Vizsla directly, but I don't think he went that far. I think he either used one meter with a switch or two separate meters on the simultaneous forward and reverse, the two directional couplers in series with each other. And you could check the operation by reversing the main input and output signal to see if the meter is read correctly in the other direction, so to speak. Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Okay, roger. All right, now I'm starting to visualize what it was. Well, yeah, it had a cap on top of it. Boy, this is a long, long time ago. yeah, I guess you could put one way, one the other way, and have a switch to flip back and forth. I don't think they had cross needle meters in those days. And I assume that, boy, I didn't even know that they were still available. But what frequency, in fact, did they go up to, was it meant for just 2 meters or go to UHF stick over?
I think Tom had versions that went all the way down to 80 meters at high power, and all the way up to at least 2 meters of 432 with much lower power. And he changed the coupling coefficients. But the design itself, with the right size coupling loop and the right distance of that coupling loop, that could be made very, very broadband in frequency. You'd have to have a calibration curve. And yes, they did use a copper end cap, a copper plumbing type end cap, as the seal on top of this telescoping piece of tubing that contained the pickup loop and the diode. And in that copper plumbing end cap is where he put the through connector, BNC or SMA or whatever it was. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Sounds fascinating remember that. Gee, it's just so many years ago, you know. I completely forgot about that. You know, that's, I guess, you know, that should be resurrected, because that sounds like it would be an ideal, you know, add-on gadget today that would be meet the needs, because I'm constantly getting people, you know, now there's more interest those days. Now, this was going back, I think, not long, around the early 70s. The interest today is VHF and UHF. This sounds like something that should be really resurrected, Dick. Over.
When I visited Tom at his headquarters at AROL, he was doing that work in roughly 1971. It appeared in a whole lot of issues of the antenna handbook, AROL antenna handbook. There's a slim chance that the modern day antenna handbook still has that directional coupler in it. I know it was definitely in some of the issues of the antenna handbook. So therefore, the literature as to how to build it and how to test it is definitely available. and to an ARRL member, nothing stopping you going back to the original article and asking for a copy of it on the website of ARRL. So the literature there to how to build it, how to align it, is definitely available. Over to you, Mel.
Roger. Yeah, I haven't seen it in the later editions, but I would have most likely come across it in the newer versions of the antenna handbook. I have not seen it. That's why it, all of a sudden, just came back into my mind that it was a very simple device, and you could go over to any of these places like Home Depot and walk right over and get all the parts for it. Literally, the only thing you'd have to do is add a couple of like dicks, a couple of connectors, and what else, a diode or whatever, what else was in there? I think there was I'm trying to remember what the circuit was like. I think he had a capacitor in there, a resistor in there, and there was a resistor, I think, that terminated the diode to ground, series, the diode to series like a loop, and then another resistor to isolate it, and I don't think it had more than, maybe it was an electronic part, maybe three parts, and the rest was all plumbing over.
Exactly. A resistor, a capacitor, maybe a little bit of a standoff circuit. I think it was maybe even built dead bug style inside of the telescoping copper tubing on a T-connector. A pair of T-connectors cascaded together on the straight through line, and the T portion of each T-connector, one of them was the forward sensor, and the other one was a reverse power sensor. And so, quite easy to duplicate, as you said. 90% of the parts came out of Home Depot or Lowe's store. How about you, Mel? And we probably have time for one more.
Thanks, very good. All right, I'm happy that you remember it quite well. And it's funny that it's, how it sort of disappeared, but something that would be quite handy for a lot of people to use today. All right, let's see, I'm trying to find something else of interest here. Ah, here's one, seeing that we are staying with tonight with VHF and UHF. Is it an advantage to stack a bunch of dipole elements? I have a dipole, homemade dipole that I made from, an old television antenna. And I turned them into dipoles for 2 meters. And I guess you can make an array, a dipole element array, I think, with dipoles. I assume you could stack them vertically, Dick, over.
Yeah, when it comes to inexpensive 2 meter antennas that have got some gain to them, one of the first things I would consider are either two articles. There's an article, I think, still existing in the ARRL antenna book, and also there's definitely an article that exists at a website by Kent Britton, WA5EJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo .com. You go to that website, you go to the right page on that website, he will show you how to make a coat hanger wire Yagi antenna for 2 meters. Very easy to reproduce. You've got a piece of fairing strip wood that goes down the center as the boom, and you stick through it with drilling holes coat hanger wire. He tells you how to cut each of the pieces of coat hanger wire and how many inches downrange on the boom to mount them. And you can easily build, I think it's a 4 or 5 or 6 element Yagi with lots of performance. And the parts to build the hold-on thing could probably be done under $5. So that's the easiest way of getting a lot of gain in a particular direction on 2 meters. Easier than stacking dipoles together and building a phasing harness. You get a lot more bang for your dollar out of a Yagi than you do out of a collinear array or a broadside array of dipoles. You get a lot more out of a Yagi, in my opinion. And it doesn't take expensive materials to do it. And if you want more gain than that, then still start building groups of these things and putting them together with radio RF T connectors to feed them. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Now, that brings up an interesting situation. You know, I picked up a lot of TV antennas. I don't know why. I saw them, aluminum elements and everything. I said, you know, I could, someday I'll make something. I'll use these things because, you know, very lightweight, but these, believe it or not, even though the elements on a TV antenna are somewhat lightweight, they still can seem like they can stand up and take quite a bit of beating up there. And what happened was all around here, of course, they were cutting them down and everybody was going on cable. So I saw a lot of them were almost new, you know, they weren't up there, you know, like, you know, they first of all, they were anodized and they were up there, not a very long in some cases. So as these able to actually, you know, they actually just snap into place the elements and, you know, I was all easy to fold them up nice and neat. So I've got a number of them in the backyard here, in the back of the garage here, stashed. And, you know, that's actually a good source for making things like 2-meter antennas. Finding one of these antennas, and you always see them in the street now, over.
Yeah, the raw aluminum tubing for antennas is there. And for the parasitic elements, no problem. Got a little bit more difficulty, though, when it comes to making good contact to that element out of aluminum for the driven element. I think you're a little bit better off making the driven element out of something you can solder to, like brass or copper or rod. Go ahead.
Okay. I guess that's one option. I did make one, a 6-meter beam, in fact, out of copper water pipe. Because I got it, you know, there were remnants they had I was at Home Depot and I saw a bin there of all pieces of copper water pipe, which you see a lot of times people come in, they want to cut to a certain length, and they leave the other part there, and they were selling it very cheap. I don't know what the situation is now because copper's gone up quite a bit, but I was able to pick up enough pieces that when I joined them together, actually just used couplings and sweated it together, made a fine antenna, so I guess that's an option, Dick, over.
That's an approach. Because somebody was asking about oil earlier, and I got a bunch of my oil pass bills in my hand, and they're all clipped together. I'm looking back here in, what year is this? I think it's around 1999. Oh, good. April of 1999. I paid 64.9 cents per gallon. Dream on. Back to you, Mel.
64 cents a gallon. It shows you what happened in a short period of time. It sounds like, you know, like a long, long time ago. And it's not that long ago. As far as, you know, we were talking earlier, I really have a few minutes left here. You know, gas versus oil. As I said, how much really do you think the amount of electric the motor on an average oil burner uses, say, how much do you think it adds to the bill a month, Dick, over?
Was there somebody who said something about oil a second ago?
Yeah, this is Antoine Anio. I have a comment about the oil and the heat.
Go right ahead.
I don't know who asked about the thermostat, what they are doing with the thermostat if the power fails. I'm traveling quite intensively through Europe, and I observed that their thermostat is actually built into the heater itself, so you can adjust the heating on a room-by-room basis. It's all mechanical. I'm not sure. I haven't seen anything like that here. Do we have anything like that, Dick, back there?
It's very rare. I lived in a house that was heated with kerosene way back in 1969, and it did have a mechanical arrangement between the thermostat function. Well, I take it back. There was a manual override. I could turn on the furnace manually, but the thermostat really did get operated electronically. But what Mel did in his case, obviously when his power failed, his little transformer that powers the thermostat no longer received power, but he put a battery in series. So a smart person could have a battery backup on his thermostat to keep the system running as long as it doesn't require a blower. His is a a gas-fired steam heat system. So with his battery backup on his thermostat, he has heat without power. It's a bit rare. But to answer your question, Mel, the actual transformer, the actual motor on my my retention head burner, which I think is capable of 1.5 gallons per hour, but I've got the nozzle down to like 6 tenths. I think that's a quarter horse motor. No, it's less. I think it's an eighth horse motor. The motor itself is only an eighth horse, which means it's using about 100 watts, 150 watts of power. The spark, the igniter, let me drop. The 10,000 volt igniter, the spark that's continuously there, just to make sure that you're not putting raw oil into the chimney, raw vaporized oil, that the flame should get blown out. That runs continuously, and I'll bet you that's consuming another 50 watts. So I'm probably burning 150 watts running the motor and the spark arrangement when my furnace is running. In my case, it's a warm air system, and now there is also a blower that runs the pushes the air around the house, and that looks like a quarter horse motor, which probably draws 200 watts. So my system probably is drawing 300 watts of electricity when it runs, is a good guess. Some people have a hot water system where you've also got circulating pumps, and I think they run about an 8 horsepower. K2KEY, K2RIW.
That old burner I had here, that motor looked like more than a third or anything. It looked like it's easily a quarter horsepower motor, if I remember correctly. Now, as far as, okay, so you're saying you're running, drawing about 300 watts. How many hours a day do you think you run the burner, Dick, over?
On a super cold day, if someone told me that because I've cut down on the nozzle, and therefore I'm running more hours, I probably run half the day, on and off. So I may be running 12 hours of 300 watts. I'm using 3.6 kilowatt hours, and I pay around 15 cents or so, 16 cents a kilowatt hour. So I'm using 50 cents worth of electricity per day on a super cold day. Go ahead.
Okay, so that's adding to your bill somewhere around $3-4 a week or so, maybe about, I don't know, possibly $15-16 a month right now. All right, well, that's why I think most likely that motor that I was running, that was running on there, was the difference of course, that even that was making, you know, the old system, even hot water was even in the coil in there, so the burner had to run, you know, to make hot water also. But that's why I would put it in, the new system in. For the summer, it's a pleasure. Basement stays nice and comfortable there, cool, because the big burner is not running, and the hot water tank, the 50-gallon hot water tank, is very well insulated, that if you touch it, you don't feel any heat coming out of it, Dick, over.
Very nice. It's probably a center flue type. In fact, most gas-fired hot water heaters are a center flue type, and my oil-fired hot water heater is a center flue type. I used to have the outer flue type, and those are a lot less efficient, in my opinion. Sounds good, Mel. Back to you, and we've got about 5 minutes left. K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Very interesting. All right, I guess so no use looking for anything else here right now. We just believe some of these are very detailed and all, but I'm happy to see that a lot of people really enjoy the TechNet. And they particularly, just looking over here, enjoyed the discussion we had on the relationship between amperes and voltmeters and neutrons and newtons and coulombs and so on and so forth. So I know there are also a lot of comments here that you guys get a little too much heavy on this stuff, but I think the pros, the pluses here, really outweigh the negatives here. I've got a lot, got some negatives here and all, and yeah, some of the things maybe should be taken into consideration, but for the whole, I think we're on the right track, Dick, so back to you, any finals. This is K2KEY.
Yeah, we've got to listen to the mail, but we've got to filter it. You can't please all the people all the time, no matter what you do. If we keep it very simple for beginners, you're going to bore the more skilled guys and vice versa. So you and I vacillate up and down between simple stuff and pretty complicated stuff. But the main function of last week's discussion, as I see it, was the fact that this is a global economy. You may not like it. It is global. By way of that internet, we are all connected. When it comes to manufacture, a hell of a lot of our stuff for a lot of years is coming from Southeast Asia because they can manufacture it at rather high quality, rather low cost, and rather large volume. So we have to adapt to that. And the rest of the world is on the metric system. You and I have lived our whole life on the English system, and we think that's all there is. 95% of planet Earth lives metrically. They measure distance in kilometers and meters and centimeters and millimeters. They measure fluids in liters. They measure weights of things in kilograms. They measure temperatures in degrees centigrade. That's the way 95% of the world lives. And if we're going to be part of this world, and we are because of the global economy, you're going to have to learn some of that vocabulary. I've run into that quite often in my business, and it's going to be happening more and more. 73, you all. You just wasted another 4 hours of your life listening to TechNet number 1,216. And on the assumption we stay healthy, Mel and I will be back next week and try to do more of it. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Nothing to add to that, except, okay, we'll try to, like I say, get to as many of these emails, but please try to keep them basically, again, in the realm of amateur radio, and we can't get into, again, because it seems like people forget real quick, I say this every so often, that we can't get into these manuscripts or whatever. You've got ideas to develop a product or submit an article. We're not the ones. Submit it to ARRL or CQ or one of those magazines. We're not a, we don't review, you know, future articles for them. We're not involved with them. We're not on their so-called payroll. Okay, 73s. We'll talk to everybody hopefully next week. Take care, and thank you for joining us. This is K2KEY.
Now I'm going to add a couple more words to what Mel just said. And that is, you sign into our TechNet live verbally, whether you do it by internet or one of the input frequencies of this repeater or the out east repeater on 147.375. You get to us verbally, and we will handle almost any subject. When it comes to written material, there is no guarantee. Mel and I are not trying to run a free consulting service in writing. You write to us an elaborate question and submit a manuscript. You're taking the risk, you are taking the risk that you might not get an answer. There's no guarantees. We guarantee to discuss almost anything of mild interest to radio amateurs when it comes to the live program. Mel and I can talk 150 words a minute. We like talking. We do not like writing and typing. So your stuff that you write and type to us got to be kept direct and simple, and it is not a free consulting service. You may think it is. You may wish it is. I don't blame you for wishing it. We have not promised that. Good luck, you guys. Bye-bye for now.
K2IRW, N2N in your postnet.
Go ahead, Alex.
Listen, I just had an accident here. My old HPA Logic, Spectrum Analyzer, the 141T just lost its first mixer. Any ideas what I can do?
Yeah, I have blown out a number of those first mixers. If you do anything with the RF attenuator on the front panel set at 0 decibels, and if you ever come close to or exceeding 1.0 volts, positive or negative, on that semiconductor, you've blown that diode. If you exceed about 100 milliwatts of power, maybe 500 milliwatts, but something in that order. You exceed 500 milliwatts of power, or you exceed 1 volt, or even if you take a charged piece of cable with more than a volt on it and simply connect it to that front panel while the RF attenuator is set at zero, you can blow that first mixer. If you want to be on the safe side, you should never start a measurement without the RF attenuator set at least 10 dB. The mixer is a replaceable assembly, and there are substitute mixers. Now, when it comes to the 141T, and if it's the microwave version, you've got the plug-in head called 555, HB555, I think it's called, the microwave plug-in head. That mixer is a replaceable assembly, and now you're going to have to do some searching on the internet to find out where to get that mixer. It is a replaceable assembly. Back to you, Alex.
Yeah, the RF section is the 8555A, the RF, microwave unit, and the mixer went through because of ESD. As long as you were talking, I was searching on the internet, I couldn't find anything. I have to probably buy the whole unit. So I don't know, this is quite a heavy stuff, so I thought perhaps I may find something locally here.
You say the whole unit, I'm not quite sure what that means. The whole plug-in unit, of course not, very expensive. The mixer is a completely separate assembly. The failure of that mixer is a very frequent failure. It is a replaceable part.